second as he found himself in the diverse Kesperets of Isordorex. The city-state was an autocracy of the most extreme kind, its excesses dwarfing the repressions of the country he'd been born in. Especially of late. Even his great friend and business partner in the Second Dominion, Herbert Nuit Saint-Georges, called Peckable by those who knew him well, a merchant who had made substantial profit from the superstitious and the woebegone in the Second Dominion, regularly remarked that the order of his Order X was growing less stable by the day, and he would soon take his family out of the city, indeed out of the Dominion entirely, and find a new home, where he would not have to smell burning bodies when he opened his windows in the morning. So far, it was only talk. Godolphin knew Peckable well enough to be certain that until he'd exhausted his supply of idols, relics and jujus from the Fifth, and could make no more profit, he'd stay put. And given that it was Godolphin himself who supplied these items, most were simply terrestrial trivia revered in the Dominions because of their place of origin, and given that he would not cease to do so as long as the fever of collection was upon him and he could exchange such items for artifacts from the Imagicka, Peckable's business would flourish. It was a trade in talismans, and neither man was likely to tire of it soon. Nor did Godolphin tire of being an Englishman in that most un-English of cities. He was instantly recognisable in the small but influential circle he kept. A large man in every way, he was tall and big-bellied, bellicose when fondest, hearty when not. At 52 he had long ago found his style and was more than comfortable with it. True, he concealed his second and third chins beneath a grey-brown beard that only got an efficient trimming at the hands of Peckable's eldest daughter, Hoi Polloi. True, he attempted to look a little more learned by wearing silver-rimmed spectacles that were dwarfed by his large face, but were, he thought, all the more pedagogish because they didn't flatter. But these were little deceits. They helped to make him unmistakable, which he liked. He wore his thinning hair short and his collars long, preferring for dress a clash of tweeds and a striped shirt, always a tie, invariably a waistcoat. All in all, a difficult sight to ignore, which suited him fine. Nothing was more likely to bring a smile to his face than being told he was talked about. It was usually with affection. There was no smile on his face now, however, as he stepped out of the sight of the reconciliation, known euphemistically as the retreat, to find Dowd sitting perched on a shooting stick a few yards from the door. It was early afternoon, but the sun was already low in the sky, the air as chilly as Dowd's welcome. It was almost enough to make him turn around and go back to his Order X, revolution or no.
"Why do I think you haven't come here with sparkling news?" he said.
Dowd rose with his usual theatricality.
"I'm afraid you're absolutely correct," he said.
"Let me guess. The government fell. The house burned down."
His face dropped.
"Not my brother," he said. "Not Charlie."
He tried to read Dowd's face.
"What, dead? A massive coronary. When was the funeral?"
"No, he's alive. But the problem lies with him."
"Always has. Always has. Will you fetch my goods and chattels out of the folly? We'll talk as we walk. Go on in, will you? There's nothing there that's going to bite."
Dowd had stayed out of the retreat all the time he'd waited for Godolphin, a wearisome 3 days, even though it would have given him some measure of protection against the bitter cold. Not that his system was susceptible to such discomforts, but he fancied himself an empathic soul, and his time on Earth had taught him to feel cold as an intellectual concept, if not a physical one, and he might have wished to take shelter. Anywhere other than the retreat. Not only had many esoterics died there, and he didn't enjoy the proximity of death unless he'd been its bringer, but the retreat was a passing place between the Fifth Dominion and the other four, including, of course, the home from which he was in permanent exile. To be so close to the door through which his home lay, and be prevented by the conjurations of his first keeper, Joshua Godolphin, from opening that door was painful. The cold was preferable. He stepped inside now, however, having no choice in the matter. The retreat had been built in neoclassical style, 12 marble pillars rising to support a dome that called for decoration but had none. The plainness of the whole lent it gravity and a certain functionalism which was not inappropriate. It was, after all, no more than a station, built to serve countless passengers and now used by only one. On the floor, set in the middle of the elaborate mosaic that appeared to be the building's sole concession to prettification, but was in fact the evidence of its true purpose, were the bundles of artefacts Godolphin brought back from his travels, neatly tied up by Hoi Polloi Nui Saint-Georges, the knots encrusted with scarlet sealing wax. It was her present delight, this business with the wax, and Dowd cursed it, given that it fell to him to unpack these treasures. He crossed to the centre of the mosaic, light on his heels. This was tremulous terrain, and he didn't trust it. But moments later he emerged with his freight, to find that Godolphin was already marching out of the copse that screened the retreat from both the house, empty, of course, in ruins, and any casual spy who peered over the wall. He took a deep breath and went after his master, knowing the explanation ahead would not be easy. 2.
So they've summoned me, have they? Oscar said as they drove back into London, the traffic thickening with the dusk. Well, let them wait.
You're not going to tell them you're here?
In my time, not in theirs. This is a mess, Dowdy. A wretched mess.
You told me to help Esterbrook if he needed it.
Helping him hard an assassin isn't what I had in mind.
Chant was very discreet.
Death makes you that way, I find. You really have made a pig's ear of the whole thing.
I protest, said Dowd. What else was I supposed to do? You knew he wanted the woman dead, and you washed your hands of it.
All true, said Godolphin. She is dead, I assume.
I don't think so. I've been scouring the papers, and there's no mention.
So why did you have Chant killed?
Here Dowd was more cautious in his account. If he said too little, Godolphin would suspect him of concealment. Too much, and the larger picture might become apparent. The longer his employer stayed in ignorance of the scale of the stakes, the better. He proffered two explanations, both ready and waiting.
For one thing, the man was more unreliable than I'd thought. Drunken maudlin half the time. And I think he knew more than was good for either you or your brother. He might have ended up finding out about your travels.
Instead, it's the society that's suspicious.
It's unfortunate the way these things turn out.
Unfortunate, my arse. A total balls-up is what it is.
I'm very sorry.
I know you are, Dowdy, Oscar said. The point is, where do we find a scapegoat?
Your brother?
Perhaps,
Godolphin replied, cannily concealing the degree to which this suggestion found favour.
When should I tell them you've come back? Dowd asked.
When I've made up a lie I can believe in, came the reply.
Back in the house in Regent's Park Road, Oscar took some time to study the newspaper reports of Chant's death before retiring to his treasure house on the third floor with both his new artefacts and a good deal to think about. A sizable part of him wanted to exit this dominion once and for all, take himself off to his Orderex and set up business with Peckable. Marry Hoi Polloi, despite her crossed eyes, have a litter of kids and retire to the hills of the conscious cloud in the third, and raise parrots. But he knew he'd yearn for England sooner or later, and a yearning man could be cruel. He'd end up beating his wife, bullying his kids, and eating the parrots. So, given that he'd always have to keep a foot in England, if only during the cricket season, and given that as long as he kept a presence here he would be answerable to the society, he had to face them. He locked the door of his treasure room, sat down amid his collection, and waited for inspiration. The shelves around him, which were built to the ceiling, were bowed beneath the weight of his trove. Here were items gathered from the edge of the Second Dominion to the limits of the Fourth. He had only to pick one of them up to be transported back to the time and place of its acquisition. The statue of the Etug Hatshit he'd bartered for, in a little town called Slough, which was now, regrettably, a blasted spot, its citizens the victims of a purge visited upon them for the crime of a song, written in the dialect of their community, suggesting that the autarch of his Orderex lacked testicles. another of his treasures, the 7th volume of Gord Maybellome's Encyclopedia of Heavenly Signs, originally written in the language of Third Dominion academics, but widely translated for the delectation of the proletariat, he'd bought from a woman in the city of Jassik, who'd approached him in a gaming room, where he was attempting to explain cricket to a group of the locals, and said she recognised him from stories her husband, who was in the Autarch's army in Isordorex, had told.
"You're the English mail,"
she'd said, which didn't seem worth denying. Then she'd shown him the book, a very rare volume indeed. He'd never ceased to find fascination within its pages, for it was Maybellome's intention to make an encyclopedia listing all the flora, fauna, languages, sciences, ideas, moral perspectives, in short, anything that occurred to her, that had found their way from the 5th Dominion, the place of the succulent rock, through to the other worlds. It was a Herculean task, and she'd died just as she was beginning the 19th volume, with no end in sight. But even the one book in Godolphin's possession was enough to guarantee that he would search for the others until his dying day. It was a bizarre, almost surreal volume. Even if only half the entries were true, or nearly true, Earth had influenced just about every aspect of the worlds from which it was divided. Fauna, for instance. There were countless animals listed in the volume which Maybellome claimed to be invaders from the other world. Some clearly were: the zebra, the crocodile, the dog. Others were a mixture of genetic strands, part terrestrial, part not. But many of these species, pictured in the book like fugitives from a medieval bestiary, were so outlandish he doubted their very existence. Here, for instance, were hand-sized wolves with the wings of canaries. Here was an elephant that lived in an enormous conch. Here was a literate worm that wrote omens with its thread-fine half-mile body. Wonderment upon wonderment. Godolphin only had to pick up the encyclopedia, and he was ready to put on his boots and set off for the Dominions again. What was self-evident from even a casual perusal of the book was how extensively the unreconciled Dominion had influenced the others. The languages of Earth, English, Italian, Hindustani, and Chinese particularly, were known in some variation everywhere, though it seemed the Autarch, who had come to power in the confusion following the failed reconciliation, favoured English, which was now the preferred linguistic currency almost everywhere. To name a child with an English word was thought particularly propitious, though there was little or no consideration given to what the word actually meant. Hence, hoi polloi, for instance. This one of the less strange namings among the thousands Godolphin had encountered. He flattered himself that he was in some small part responsible for such blissful bizarrities, given that over the years he'd brought all manner of influences through from the succulent rock. There was always a hunger for newspapers and magazines, usually preferred to books, and he'd heard of baptizers in Patashoqua who named children by stabbing a copy of the London Times with a pin and bequeathing the first 3 words they pricked upon the infant, however unmusical the combination. But he was not the only influence. He hadn't brought the crocodile or the zebra or the dog, though he would lay claim to the parrot. No, there had always been routes through from Earth into the Dominions, other than that at the retreat. Some, no doubt, had been opened by maestros and esoterics in all manner of cultures for the express purpose of their passing to and fro between worlds. Others were conceivably opened by accident, and perhaps remained open, marking the sites as haunted or sacred, shunned or obsessively protected. Yet others, these in the smallest number, had been created by the sciences of the other dominions as a means of gaining access to the heaven of the succulent rock. In such a place, this near the walls of the Irmandas in the Third Dominion, Godolphin had acquired his most sacred possession, a Boston bowl, complete with its 41 coloured stones. Though he'd never used it, the bowl was reputedly the most accurate prophetic tool known in the worlds, and now, sitting amid his treasures, with a sense growing in him that events on Earth in the last few days were leading to some matter of moment, he brought the bowl down from its place on the highest shelf, unwrapped it, and set it on the table. Then he took the stones from their pouch and laid them at the bottom of the bowl. Truth to tell, The arrangement didn't look particularly promising. The bowl resembled something for kitchen use, plain-fired ceramic, large enough to whip eggs for a couple of soufflés. The stones were more colourful, varying in size and shape from tiny flat pebbles to perfect spheres the size of an eyeball. Having set them out, Godolphin had second thoughts. Did he even believe in prophecy? And if he did, was it wise to know the future? Probably not. Death was bound to be in there somewhere, sooner or later. Only maestros and deities lived forever, and a man might sour the balance of his span, knowing when it was going to end. But then, suppose he found in this bowl some indication as to how the society might be handled. That would be no small weight off his shoulders.
Be brave,
he told himself, and laid the middle finger of each hand upon the rim, as Peckable, who'd once owned such a bowl and had it smashed by his wife in a domestic row, had instructed. Nothing happened at first, but Peckable had warned him the bowls usually took some time to start from cold. He waited and waited. The first sight of activation was a rattling from the bottom of the bowl, as the stones began to move against each other. The second, a distinctly acidic odour rising to jab at his sinuses. The third, and most startling, the sudden ricocheting of one pebble, then two, then a dozen, across the bowl and back, several skipping higher than the rim. Their ambition increased by the movement until all 41 were in violent motion, so violent that the bowl began to move across the table, and Oscar had to take a firm hold of it to keep it from turning over. The stones struck his fingers and knuckles with stinging force, but the pain was made sweeter by the success that now followed, as the speed and motion of the multifarious shapes and colours began to describe images in the air above the bowl. Like all prophecy, the signs were in the eye of the beholder, and perhaps another witness would have seen different forms in the blur. But what Godolphin saw seemed quite plain to him. The retreat, for one, half hidden in the copse. Then himself standing in the middle of the mosaic, either coming back from his orderex or preparing to depart. The images lingered for only a brief time before changing, the retreat demolished in the storm of stones and a new structure raised in the whirl. The tower of the Tabula Rasa. He fixed his eyes on the prophecy with fresh deliberation, denying himself the comfort of blinking to be certain he missed nothing. The tower, as seen from the street, gave way to its interior. Here they were, the wise ones, sitting around the table contemplating their divine duty. They were naval defluffers and snot-rollers to a man. Not one of them would be capable of surviving an hour in the alleyways of East Isorderex, he thought, down by the harbour where even the cats had pimps. Now he saw himself step into the picture, and something he was doing or saying made the men and women before him jump from their seats, even Lionel.
"What's this?"
Oscar murmured. They had wild expressions on their faces, every one. Were they laughing? What had he done? Cracked a joke? Passed wind? He studied the prophecy more closely. No, it wasn't humour on their faces. It was horror. "Sir?" Dowd's voice from outside the door broke his concentration. He looked away from the bowl for a few seconds to snap,
"Go away!"
But Dowd had urgent news. "McGann's on the telephone," he said.
"Tell him you don't know where I am,"
Oscar snorted, returning his gaze to the bowl. Something terrible had happened in the time between his looking away and looking back. The horror remained on their faces, but for some reason he'd disappeared from the scene. Had they dispatched him summarily? God, was he dead on the floor? Maybe. There was something glistening on the table, like spilled blood.
Sir?
Fuck off, Dowdy!
They know you're here, sir.
They knew. They knew. The house was being watched, and they knew.
All right, he said. Tell them I'll be down in a moment.
What did you say, sir?
Oscar raised his voice over the din of the stones, looking away again, this time more willingly.
"Get his whereabouts! I'll call him back!"
Again he returned his gaze to the bowl, and his concentration had faltered, and he could no longer interpret the images concealed in the motion of the stones, except for one. As the speed of the display slowed, he seemed to catch, oh so fleetingly, a woman's face in the melee. His replacement at the society's table, perhaps. Or his dispatcher. 3. He needed a drink before he spoke to McGann. Dowd, ever the anticipator, had already mixed him a whiskey and soda, but he forsook it for fear it would loosen his tongue. Paradoxically, what had been half revealed by the Boston bowl helped him in his exchange. In extreme circumstances, he responded with almost pathological detachment. It was one of his most English traits. He had thus seldom been cooler or more controlled than now, as he told McGann that yes, indeed, he had been travelling, and no, it was none of the society's business, where or about what pursuit. He would, of course, be delighted to attend a gathering at the Tower the following day, but was McGann aware, indeed did he care, that tomorrow was Christmas Eve?
"I never miss midnight mass at St. Martin in the Fields," Oscar told him. "So I'd appreciate it greatly if the meeting could be concluded quickly enough to allow me time to get there and find a pew with a good view."
He delivered all of this without a tremor in the voice. McGann attempted to press him as to his whereabouts in the last few days, to which Oscar asked why the hell it mattered.
"I don't ask about your private affairs now, do I?" he said in a mildly affronted tone. "Nor, by the way, do I spy on your comings and goings. Don't splatter, McGann. You don't trust me, and I don't trust you. I will take tomorrow's meeting as a forum to debate the privacy of the Society's members, and a chance to remind the gathering that the name of Godolphin is one of the cornerstones of the Society."
"All the more reason for you to be forthright," McGann said.
"I'll be perfectly forthright," was Oscar's reply. "You'll have ample evidence of my innocence."
Only now, with a war of wits won, did he accept the whisky and soda Dowd had mixed for him.
"Ample and definitive."
He silently toasted Dowd as he talked, knowing as he sipped it that there'd be blood shed before Christmas Day dawned. Grim as that prospect was, there was no avoiding it now. When he put the phone down, he said to Dowd,
"I think I'll wear the herringbone suit tomorrow. And a plain shirt, white, starched collar."
"And the tie?" Dowd asked, replacing Oscar's drained glass with a fresh one.
"I'll be going straight on to midnight mass," Oscar said.
"Black, then?"
"Black."
Chapter 10 1 The afternoon of the day following the assassin's appearance at Marlin's apartment, a blizzard descended upon New York with no little ferocity, conspiring with the inevitable seasonal rush to make finding a flight back to England difficult. But Jude was not easily denied anything, especially when she set her mind firmly on an objective, and she was certain, despite Marlin's protestations, that leaving Manhattan was the most sensible thing to do. She had reason on her side. The assassin had made 2 attempts upon her life. He was still at large. As long as she stayed in New York, she would be under threat. But even if this had not been the case, and there was a part of her that still believed that he'd come that second time to explain, or apologize, she would have found an excuse for returning to England just to be out of Marlin's company. He had become too cloying in his affections, his talk as saccharine as the dialogue from the Christmas classics on the television, his every gaze mawkish. He'd had this sickness all along, of course, but he'd worsened since the assassin's visit, and her tolerance for its symptoms, braced as she'd been by her encounter with Gentle, had dropped to 0. Once she'd put the phone down on him the previous night, she'd regretted her skittish way with him, and after a heart-to-heart with Marlin in which she'd told him she wanted to go back to England, and he'd replied that it would all seem different in the morning and why didn't she just take a pill and lie down, she'd decided to call him back. By this time Marlin was sound asleep. She'd left her bed, gone through to the living room, put on a single lamp and made the call. It felt covert, which in a way it was. Marlin had not been pleased to know that one of her ex-lovers had attempted to play hero in his own apartment, and he wouldn't have been happy to find her making contact with Gentle at 2 in the morning. She still didn't know what had happened when she'd been put through to the room. The receiver had been picked up and then dropped, leaving her to listen with increasing fury and frustration to the sound of Gentle making love. Instead of putting the phone down there and then, she'd listened, half wishing she could have joined the escapade. Eventually, after failing to distract Gentle from his labours, she'd hung up and traipsed back to her cold bed, in a foul humour. He'd called the next day, and Marlin had answered. She let him tell Gentle that if he ever saw hide or hair of Gentle in the building again, he'd have him arrested as an accomplice to attempted murder.
"What did he say?"
she'd asked, when the conversation was done.
"Not very much. He sounded drunk."
She had not discussed the matter any further. Marlin was already sullen enough after her breakfast announcement that she still intended to return to England that day. He'd asked her over and over, why? Was there something he could do to make her stay more comfortable? Extra locks on the doors, a promise that he wouldn't leave her side. None of these, of course, filling her with renewed enthusiasm for staying. If she told him once, she told him 24 times that he was quite the perfect host, and that he wasn't to take this personally, but she wanted to be back in her own house, her own city, where she would feel most protected from the assassin. He'd then offered to come back with her, so she wasn't returning to an empty house alone. At which point, running out of soothing phrases and patience, she told him that alone was exactly what she wanted to be. And so here she was. One snail crawl through the blizzard to Kennedy, a 5-hour delay, and a flight in which she was wedged between a nun who prayed aloud every time they hit an air pocket, and a child in need of worming, later. Her own sole possessor, in an empty flat, on Christmas Eve. 2. The painting, in 4 contrary modes, was there to greet Gentle when he got back to the studio. His return had been delayed by the same blizzard that had almost prevented Judith from leaving Manhattan, and put him beyond the deadline Klein had set. But his thoughts had not turned to his business dealings with Klein more than once during the journey. They'd revolved almost entirely around the encounter with the assassin. Whatever mischief Pai O-Pa had worked upon his system, it had cleared by the following morning. His eyes were operating normally, and he was lucid enough to deal with the practicalities of departure. But the echoes of what he'd experienced still reverberated. Dozing on the plane, he felt the smoothness of the assassin's face in his fingertips, the tumble of hair he'd taken to be Jude's over the back of his hands. He could still smell the scent of wet skin, and feel the weight of Pai O-Pa's body on his hips. This so persuasive he had an erection apparent enough to draw a stare from one of the flight attendants. He reasoned that perhaps he would have to put fresh sensation between these echoes and their origins. Fuck them out. Sweat himself clean. The thought comforted him. When he dozed again, and the memories returned, he didn't fight them, knowing he had a means of scouring them from his system once he got back to England. Now he sat in front of the painting in 4 modes and flipped through his address book, looking for a partner for the night. He made a few calls, but couldn't have chosen a worse time to be setting up a casual liaison. Husbands were home, family gatherings were in the offing. He was out of season. He did eventually speak to Klein, who after some persuasion accepted his apologies and then went on to tell him there was to be a party at Taylor and Clem's house the following day, and he was sure Gentle would be welcome if he had no other plans.
"Everyone says it'll be Taylor's last," Chester said. "I know he'd like to see you."
"I suppose I should go, then," Gentle said.
"You should. He's very sick. He's had pneumonia, and now cancer. He was always very fond of you, you know."
The association of ideas made fondness for Gentle sound like another disease. But he didn't comment on it, merely made arrangements to pick up Klein the following evening and put down the phone, plunged into a deeper trough than ever. He'd known Taylor had the plague, but hadn't realized people were counting the days to his demise. Such grim times. Everywhere he looked, things were coming apart. There seemed to be only darkness ahead, full of blurred shapes and pitiful glances. The age of Pai O-Pa, perhaps. The time of the assassin. He didn't sleep, despite being tired, but sat up into the small hours with an object of study that he'd previously dismissed as fanciful nonsense, Chance's final letter. When he'd first read it, on the plane to New York, it had seemed a ludicrous outpouring. But there had been strange times since then, and they'd put Gentle in an apter mood for this study. Pages that had seemed worthless a few days before were now pored over, in the hope they'd yield some clue encoded in the fanciful excesses of Chance's idiosyncratic and ill-punctuated prose that would lead him to some fresh comprehension of the times and their movers. Whose god, for instance, was this Hapaxamendios that Chant exhorted Esterbrook to pray to and praise? He came trailing synonyms, the unbeheld, the aboriginal, the wanderer. And what was the greater plan that Chant hoped in his final hours he was a part of? "I am ready for death in this dominion," he'd written, "if I know that the unbeheld has used me as his instrument. All praise to Hapaxamendios, for he was in the place of the succulent rock and left his children to suffer here, and I have suffered here and am done with suffering." That at least was true. The man had known his death was imminent, which suggested he'd known his murderer too. Was it Pi Opa he'd been expecting? It seemed not. The assassin was referred to, but not as Chance's executioner. Indeed, in his first reading of the letter, Gentle hadn't even realized it was Pi Opa who was being spoken of in this passage. But on this re-reading, it was completely apparent. "You have made a covenant with a rare thing in this dominion or any other, and I do not know if this death nearly upon me is my punishment or my reward for my agency in that. But be circumspect in all your dealings with it, for such power is capricious, being a stew of kinds and possibilities, no utter thing in any part of its nature, but pavonine and prismatic, an apostate to its core. I was never the friend of this power. It has only adorers and undoers, but it trusted me as its representative, and I have done it as much harm in these dealings as I have you. More, I think, for it is a lonely thing and suffers in this dominion as I have. You have friends who know you for the man you are and do not have to conceal your true nature. Cling to them and their love for you, for the place of the succulent rock is about to shake and tremble, and in such a time all a soul has is the company of its loving like. I say this, having lived in such a time, and I'm glad that if such is coming upon the fifth dominion again, I will be dead, and my face turned to the glory of the unbeheld. All praise to Hapaxamendios, and to you, sir, in this moment. I offer my contrition and my prayers." There was a little more, but both handwriting and the sentence structure deteriorated rapidly thereafter, as though Chant had panicked and scrawled the rest while putting on his coat. The more coherent passages contained enough hints to keep Gentle from sleep, however. The descriptions of Pi Opa were particularly alarming. "A rare thing, a stew of kinds and possibilities." How was that to be interpreted, except as a verification of what Gentle's senses had glimpsed in New York? If so, what was this creature that had stood before him, naked and singular but concealed multitudes? This power Chant had said possessed no friends. "It has only adorers and undoers," he'd written, "and had been done as much harm in these dealings," again Chant's words, "as Esterbrook, to whom Chant had offered his contrition and his prayers. Not human, for certain. Not born of any tribe or nation Gentle was familiar with." He read the letter over and over again, and with each re-reading, the possibility of belief crept closer. He felt its proximity. It was fresh from the margins of that land he'd first suspected in New York. The thought of being there had made him fearful then, but it no longer did, perhaps because it was Christmas morning, and time for something miraculous to appear and change the world. The closer they crept, both mourning and belief, the more he regretted shunning the assassin when it had so plainly wanted his company. He had no clues to its mystery but those contained in Chance's letter, and after 100 readings they were exhausted. He wanted more. The only other source was his memory of the creature's jigsaw face, and, knowing his propensity for forgetting, they'd start to fade all too soon. He had to set them down. That was the priority now, to set the vision down before it slipped away. He threw the letter aside and went to stare at his supper at Emmaus. Was any of those styles capable of capturing what he'd seen? He doubted it. He'd have to invent a new mode. Fired up by that ambition, he turned the supper on end and began to squeeze burnt umber directly onto the canvas, spreading it with a palette knife until the scene beneath was completely obscured. In its place was now a dark ground, into which he started to gouge the outline of a figure. He had never studied anatomy very closely. The male body was of little aesthetic interest to him, and the female was so mutable, so much a function of its own motion or that of light across it, that all static representation seemed to him doomed from the outset. But he wanted to represent a protean form now, however impossible, wanted to find a way to fix what he'd seen at the door of his hotel room when Pi O'Pa's many faces had been shuffled in front of him like cards in an illusionist's deck. If he could fix that sight, or even begin to do so, he might yet find a way of controlling the thing that had come to haunt him. He worked in a fair frenzy for 2 hours, making demands of the paint he'd never made before, plastering it on with palette knife and fingers, attempting to capture at least the shape and proportion of the thing's head and neck. He could see the image clearly enough in his mind's eye. Since that night, no 2 rememberings had been more than a minute apart, but even the most basic sketch eluded his hand. He was badly equipped for the task. He'd been a parasite for too long, a mere copier, echoing other men's visions. Now he finally had one of his own, only one, but all the more precious for that, and he simply couldn't set it down. He wanted to weep at this final defeat, but he was too tired. With his hands still covered in paint, he lay down on the chilly sheets and waited for sleep to take his confusions away. 2 thoughts visited him as he slipped into dreams. The first, that with so much burnt umber on his hands he looked as though he'd been playing with his own shit. The second, that the only way to solve the problem on the canvas was to see its subject again in the flesh, which thought he welcomed, and went to dreams relieved of his frauds and pieties, smiling to think of having the rare thing's face before him once again. Chapter 11. Though the journey from Godolphin's house in Primrose Hill to the Tabula Rasa's tower was short, and Dowd got him up to Highgate on the dot of 6, Oscar suggested they drive down through Crouch End, then up through Muswell Hill and back to the tower, so that they'd arrive 10 minutes late.
"We mustn't seem to be too eager to prostrate ourselves," he observed as they approached the tower for a second time. "It'll only make them arrogant. Shall I wait down here? Cold and lonely? My dear Dowdy, out of the question. We'll ascend together, bearing gifts."
"What gifts?"
"Our wit. Our taste in suits. Well, my taste. In essence, ourselves."
They got out of the car and went to the porch, their every step monitored by cameras mounted above the door. The lock clicked as they approached and they stepped inside. As they crossed the foyer to the lift, Godolphin whispered,
"Whatever happens tonight, Dowdy, please remember..."
He got no further. The lift doors opened and Bloxham appeared as preening as ever.
"Pretty tie," Oscar said to him. "Yellow's your colour."
The tie was blue.
"Don't mind my man Dowd here, will you? I never go anywhere without him."
"He's got no place here tonight," Bloxham said.
Again, Dowd offered to wait below, but Oscar would have none of it.
"Heaven forfend," he said. "You can wait upstairs. Enjoy the view."
All this irritated Bloxham mightily, but Oscar was not an easy man to deny. They ascended in silence. Once on the top floor, Dowd was left to entertain himself, and Bloxham led Godolphin through to the chamber. They were all waiting, and there was accusation on every face. A few, Shales, certainly, and Charlotte Fever,
didn't attempt to disguise their pleasure, that the society's most ebullient and unrepentant member was here, finally called to heel.
"Oh, I'm sorry,"
Oscar said as they closed the doors behind him.
"Have you been waiting long?"
Outside, in one of the deserted antechambers, Dowd listened to his tinny little radio and mused. At 7, the news bulletin brought a report of a motorway collision which had claimed the lives of an entire family travelling north for Christmas, and of prison riots that had ignited in Bristol and Manchester, with inmates claiming that presents from loved ones had been tampered with and destroyed by prison officers. There was the usual collection of war updates, then the weather report, which promised a grey Christmas accompanied by a spring-like balm. This would, on past experience, coax the crocuses out in Hyde Park, only to be spiked by frost in a few days' time. At 8, still waiting by the window, he heard a second bulletin correcting one of the reports from the first. A survivor had been claimed from the entangled vehicles on the motorway. A tot of 3 months, found orphaned but unscathed in the wreckage. Sitting in the cold gloom, Dowd began to weep quietly, which was an experience as far beyond his true emotional capacity as cold was beyond his nerve endings. But he'd trained himself in the craft of grief with the same commitment to feigning humanity as he had learning to shiver. His tutor, the bard, Lear, his favourite lesson. He cried for the child and for the crocuses, and was still moist-eyed when he heard the voices in the chamber suddenly rise up in rage. The door was flung open and Oscar called him in, despite shouts of complaint from some of the other members.
"This is an outrage, Godolphin," Bloxham yelped. "You drive me to it," was Oscar's reply, his performance at fever pitch.
Clearly he'd been having a bad time of it. The sinews in his neck stood out like knotted string. Sweat gleamed in the pouches beneath his eyes. Every word brought flecks of spittle.
"You don't know the half of it," he was saying. "Not the half. We're being conspired against by forces we can barely conceive of. This man Chant was undoubtedly one of their agents. They can take human form."
"Godolphin, this is absurd," Alice Tirrett said.
"You don't believe me?"
"No, I don't. And I certainly don't want your bum boy here listening to us debate. Will you please remove him from the chamber?"
"But he has evidence to support my thesis," Oscar insisted.
"Oh, does he?" said Shales.
"He'll have to show you himself," Oscar said, turning to Dowd. "You're going to have to show them, I'm afraid," he said,
and as he spoke, reached into his jacket. An instant before the blade emerged, Dowd realised Godolphin's intent and started to turn away, but Oscar had the edge, and it came forth, glittering. Dowd felt his master's hand on his neck and heard shouts of horror on all sides. Then he was thrown back across the table, sprawling beneath the lights like an unwilling patient. The surgeon followed through with one swift stab, striking Dowd in the middle of his chest.
"You want proof?"
Oscar yelled, through Dowd's screams and the din of shouts around the table.
"You want proof? Then here it is."
His bulk put weight behind the blade, driving it first to the right, then to the left, encountering no obstruction from rib or breastbone. Nor was there blood, only a fluid, the colour of brackish water, that dribbled from the wounds and ran across the table. Dowd's head thrashed to and fro as this indignity was visited upon him, only once raising his gaze to stare accusingly at Godolphin, who was too busy about this undoing to return the look. Despite protests from all sides, he didn't halt his labours until the body before him had been opened from the navel to throat, and Dowd's thrashings had ceased. The stench from the carcass filled the chamber, a pungent mixture of sewage and vanilla. It drove two of the witnesses to the door, one of them Bloxham, whose nausea overtook him before he could reach the corridor. But his gaggings and moans didn't stop Godolphin by a beat. Without hesitation, he plunged his arm into the open body, and rummaging there, pulled out a fistful of gut. It was a knotty mass of blue and black tissue, final proof of Dowd's inhumanity. Triumphant, he threw the evidence down on the table beside the body, then stepped away from his handiwork,
chucking the knife into the wound it had opened. The whole performance had taken no more than a minute, but in that time he'd succeeded in turning the chamber's table into a fish market gutter.
"Satisfied,"
he said. All protest had been silenced. The only sound was the rhythmical hiss of fluid escaping an opened artery. Very quietly, McGann said,
"You're a fucking maniac."
Oscar reached gingerly into his trouser pocket and teased out a fresh handkerchief. One of poor Dowd's last tasks had been its pressing. It was immaculate. He shook out its scalpel creases and began to clean his hands.
"How else was I going to prove my point?" he said. "You drove me to this. Now there's the evidence in all its glory. I don't know what happened to Dowd, my bum boy, I think you called him, Alice, but wherever he is, this thing took his place."
"How long have you known?" Charlotte asked.
"I've suspected for the last 2 weeks. I was here in the city all the time, watching its every move, while it and you thought I was disporting myself in sunnier climes."
"What the bugger is it?"
Lionel wanted to know, prodding a scrap of alien entrail with his finger.
"God alone knows," Godolphin said. "Something not of this world, clearly."
"What did it want?" Alice said. "That's more to the point."
"Now to guess, access to this chamber, which," he looked at those around the table one by one, "I gather you granted it 3 days ago. I trust none of you was indiscreet."
Furtive glances were exchanged.
"Oh, you were," he said. "That's a pity. Let's hope it didn't have time to communicate any of its findings to its overlords."
"What's done's done," McCann said, "and we must all bear some part of the responsibility, including you, Oscar. You should have shared your suspicions with us."
"Would you have believed me?"
Oscar replied.
"I didn't believe it myself at first until I started to notice little changes in Dowd."
"Why you?" Shales said.
"That's what I want to know. Why would they target you for this surveillance, unless they thought you were more susceptible than the rest of us?" "Maybe they thought you'd join them. Maybe you have." "As usual, Hubert, you're too self-righteous to see your own frailties,"
Godolphin replied.
"How do you know I am the only one they targeted? Could you swear to me every one of your circle is above suspicion? How closely do you watch your friends, your family? Any one of them might be a part of this conspiracy."
It gave Oscar a perverse joy to sow these doubts. He saw them taking root already, saw faces that half an hour before had been puffed up with their own infallibility, deflated by doubt. It was worth the risk he'd taken with these theatrics just to see them afraid. But Shales wouldn't leave this bone alone.
"The fact remains this thing was in your employ," he said.
"We've heard enough, Hubert," McGann said softly. "This is no time for divisive talk. We've got a fight on our hands, and whether we agree with Oscar's methods or not, and just for the record I don't, surely none of us can doubt his integrity."
He glanced around the table. There were murmurs of accord on all sides.
"God knows what a creature like this might have been capable of had it realized its ruse had been discovered. Godolphin took a very considerable risk on our behalf."
"I agree,"
Lionel said. He'd come around to Oscar's side of the table and placed a glass of neat malt whiskey in the executioner's freshly wiped fingers.
"Good man, I say," he remarked. "I'd have done the same. Drink up."
Oscar accepted the glass.
"Salut,"
he said, downing the whiskey in one.
"I see nothing to celebrate," said Charlotte Fever,
the first to sit down at the table despite what lay upon it. She lit a fresh cigarette, expelling the smoke through pursed lips.
"Assuming Godolphin's right, and this thing was attempting to get access to the society, we have to ask why."
"Ask away,"
Shales said dryly, indicating the corpse.
"He's not going to be telling us very much, which is no doubt convenient for some." "How much longer do I have to endure this innuendo?"
Oscar demanded.
"I said we've heard enough, Hubert,"
McGann remarked.
"This is a democratic gathering," Shales said, rising to challenge McGann's unspoken authority. "If I've got something to say..."
"You've already said it,"
Lionel remarked with well-lubricated vim.
"Now why don't you just shut up?"
"The point is, what do we do now?" Bloxham said.
He'd returned to the table, his chin wiped, and was determined to reassert himself, following his unmanly display.
"This is a dangerous time."
"That's why they're here," said Alice. "They know the anniversary's coming up, and they want to start the whole damn reconciliation over again."
"Why try and penetrate the society?" Bloxham said.
"To put a spoke in our wheels," Lionel said. "If they know what we're planning, they can outmaneuver us. By the way, was the tie furiously expensive?"
Bloxham looked down to see that his silk tie was comprehensively spattered with puke. Casting a rancorous look in Lionel's direction, he tore it from his neck.
"I don't see what they could find out from us anyway," said Charlotte Fever, in her distracted manner. "We don't even know what the reconciliation is."
"Yes, we do," Shales said. "Our ancestors were trying to put Earth into the same orbit as heaven."
"Very poetic," Charlotte remarked. "But what does that mean, in concrete terms? Does anybody know?"
There was silence.
"I thought not. Here we are, sworn to prevent something we don't even understand."
"It was an experiment of some kind," Bloxham said, "and it failed."
"Were they all insane?" Alice said.
"Let's hope not," Lionel put in. "Insanity usually runs in a family."
"Well, I'm not crazy," Alice said, "and I'm damn sure my friends are as sane and normal and human as I am. If they were anything else, I'd know it."
"Godolphin," McGann said, "you've been uncharacteristically quiet."
"I'm soaking up the wisdom," Oscar replied.
"Have you reached any conclusions?"
"Things go in cycles," he said, taking his time to reply.
He was as certain of his audience as any man could ever hope to be.
"We're coming to the end of the millennium. Reason'll be supplanted by unreason, detachment by sentiment. I think if I were a fledgling esoteric with a nose for history, it wouldn't be difficult to turn up details of what was attempted, the experiment, as Bloxham called it, and maybe get it into my head that the time was right to try again."
"Very plausible," said McGann.
"Where would such an adept get the information?" Shales inquired.
"Self-taught."
"From what source? We've got every tome of any value buried in the ground beneath us."
"Everyone," said Godolphin. "How can we be so sure?"
"Because there hasn't been a significant act of magic performed on Earth in 2 centuries,
was Shales's reply.
"The esoterics are powerless, lost. If there'd been the least sign of magical activity, we'd know about it."
"We didn't know about Godolphin's little friend,"
Charlotte pointed out, denying Oscar the pleasure of that irony dropping from his own lips.
"Are we even sure the library's intact?" Charlotte went on. "How do we know books haven't been stolen?"
"Who by?" said Bloxham.
"By doubt, for one. They've never been properly catalogued. I know that Leash woman attempted it, but we all know what happened to her."
The tale of the Leash woman, who had been a member of the society, was one of its lesser shames. A catalogue of accidents that had ended in tragedy. In essence, the obsessive Clara Leash had taken it upon herself to make a full account of the volumes in the society's possession, and had suffered a stroke while doing so. She'd lain for 3 days on the cellar floor. By the time she was discovered, she was barely alive and quite without her wits. She survived, however, and 11 years later was still a resident in a hospice in Sussex, witless as ever.
"It still shouldn't be that difficult to find out if the place has been tampered with," Charlotte said.
Bloxham agreed.
"That shall be looked into," he said. "I take it you're volunteering," said McGann.
"And if they didn't get their information from downstairs," Charlotte said, "there are other sources.
We don't believe we have every last book dealing with the Imagicka in our hands, do we?
No, of course not, said McGann. But the Society has broken the back of the tradition over the years. The cults in this country aren't worth a damn, we all know that. They cobble workings together from whatever they can scrape up. It's all piecemeal, senseless. None of them have the wherewithal to conceive of a reconciliation. Most of them don't even know what the Imagicka is. They're putting hexes on their bosses at the bank.
Godolphin had heard similar speeches for years. Talk of magic in the Western world as a spent force. Self-congratulatory accounts of cults that have been infiltrated and discovered to be groups of pseudo-scientists, exchanging arcane theories in a language no two of them agreed upon. Or sexual obsessives using the excuse of workings to demand favours they couldn't seduce from their partners. Or, most often, crazes in search of some mythology, however ludicrous, to keep them from complete psychosis. But among the fakes, obsessives, and lunatics, was there perhaps a man who instinctively knew the route to the Imagicka? A natural maestro, born with something in his genes that made him capable of reinventing the workings of the reconciliation. Until now the possibility hadn't occurred to Godolphin. He'd been too preoccupied by the secret that he'd lived with most of his adult life, but it was an intriguing and disturbing thought.
"I believe we should take the risk seriously," he pronounced, "however unlikely we think it is." "What risk?" McGann said. "That there is a maestro out there, somebody who understands our forefathers' ambition and is going to find his own way of repeating the experiment. Maybe he doesn't want the books. Maybe he doesn't need the books. Maybe he's sitting at home somewhere, even now, working out the problems for himself."
"So what do we do?" said Charlotte.
"We purge," said Shales. "It pains me to say it, but Godolphin's right. We don't know what's going on out there. We've kept an eye on things from a distance, and occasionally arranged to have somebody put under permanent sedation. But we haven't purged. I think we've got to begin."
"How do we go about that?" Bloxham wanted to know. He had a zealot's gleam in his dishwater eyes.
"We've got our allies. We use them. We turn over every stone. And if we find anything we don't like, we kill it."
"We're not an assassination squad."
"We have the finances to hire one," Shales pointed out, "and the friends to cover the evidence if need be. As I see it, we have one responsibility, to prevent at all costs another attempt at reconciliation. That's what we were born to do."
He spoke with a total lack of melodrama, as though he were reciting a shopping list. His detachment impressed the room. So did the last sentiment, however blandly it was presented. Who could fail to be stirred by the thought of such purpose, reaching back over generations to the men who had gathered on this spot 2 centuries before? A few blooded survivors, swearing that they and their children and their children's children and so on, until the end of the world, would live and die with one ambition burning in their hearts, the prevention of another such apocalypse. At this juncture, McGann suggested a vote, and one was taken. There were no dissenting voices. The Society was agreed that the way forward lay in a comprehensive purge of all elements, innocent or not, who might presently be tampering or tempted to tamper with rituals intended to gain access to so-called reconciled dominions. All conventional religious structures would be excluded from this sanction, as they were utterly ineffectual and presented a useful distraction for some souls who might have been tempted towards esoteric practices. The shams and the profiteers would also be passed over. The peer-end palmists and fake psychics, the spiritualists who wrote new concertos for dead composers and sonnets for poets long since dust, all these would be left untouched. Only those who stood a chance of tripping over something imagical and acting upon it would be rooted out. It would be an extensive and sometimes brutal business, but the Society was the equal of the challenge. This was not the first purge it had masterminded, though it would be the first of this scale. The structure was in place for an invisible but comprehensive cleansing. The cults would be the prime targets. Their acolytes would be dispersed, their leaders bought off or incarcerated. It had happened before that England had been sluiced clean of every significant esoteric and thaumaturgist. Now it would happen again.
"Is the business of the day concluded?"
Oscar asked. "Only Mass calls me."
"What's to be done with the body?"
Alice Tirrett asked. Godolphin had his answer ready and waiting.
"It's my mess, and I'll clear it up,"
he said with due humility.
"I can arrange to have it buried in a motorway tonight, unless anybody has a better idea."
There were no objections.
"Just as long as it's out of here," Alice said.
"I'll need some help to wrap it up and get it down to the car. Bloxham, would you oblige?"
Reluctant to refuse, Bloxham went in search of something to contain the carcass.
"I see no reason for us to sit and watch," Charlotte said, rising from her seat. "If that's the night's business, I'm going home."
As she headed to the door, Oscar took his cue to sow one last triumphant mischief.
"I suppose we'll all be thinking the same thing tonight," he said.
"What's that?" Lionel asked.
"Oh, just that if these things are as good at imitation as they appear to be, then we can't entirely trust each other from now on. I'm assuming we're all still human at the moment, but who knows what Christmas will bring."
Half an hour later, Oscar was ready to depart for Mass. For all his earlier squeamishness, Bloxham had done well, returning Dowd's guts into the bowl of the carcass and mummifying the whole sorry slab in plastic and tape. He and Oscar had then lugged the corpse to the lift and, at the bottom, out of the tower to the car. It was a fine night, the moon a virtuous sliver in a sky rife with stars. As ever, Oscar took beauty where he could find it, and, before setting off, halted to admire the spectacle.
"Isn't it stupendous, Giles?"
"It is indeed," Bloxham replied.
"It makes my head spin. All those worlds."
"Don't worry," Bloxham replied. "We'll make sure it never happens."
Confounded by this reply, Oscar looked across at the other man to see that he wasn't looking at the stars at all, but was still busying himself with the body. It was the thought of the coming purge he found stupendous.
"That should do it,"
Bloxham said, slamming the trunk and offering his hand for shaking. Glad that he had the shadows to conceal his distaste, Oscar shook it and bid the boar good night. Very soon, he knew, he would have to choose sides, and despite the success of tonight's endeavour and the security he'd won with it, he was by no means sure that he belonged among the ranks of the purgers, even though they were certain to carry the day. But then, if his place was not there, where was his place? This was a puzzlement, and he was glad he had the soothing spectacle of midnight Mass to distract him from it. 25 minutes later, as he climbed the steps of St. Martin in the Fields, he found himself offering up a little prayer, its sentiments not so very different from those of the carols this congregation would presently be singing. He prayed that hope was somewhere out there in the city tonight, and that it might come into his heart and scour him of his doubts and confusions, a light that would not only burn in him, but would spread throughout the dominions and illuminate the Imagica from one end to the other. But if such a divinity was near, he prayed that the songs had it wrong, because sweet as tales of nativity were, time was short, and if hope was only a babe tonight, then by the time it had reached redeeming age, the worlds it had come to save would be dead.